This is Jan Rigsby, and this is the Passworks teleconference. It's July 2009, and this teleconference is going to be a composite of a lot of different concepts that I've presented before. So I bundled them all up under the title, Helping Ourselves. And the purpose that I wanted to have here on this particular topic was in bringing together concepts and topics that you could use on your own and emphasize how these can be used in your daily life to assist you in becoming more aware of whatever you want to become more aware of. So I'm keeping that general because people sometimes think that there's a let me back off on that. There's a tendency to say, you tell me what to do and I'll do it. And that tendency is because it's easier to take clear and direct instructions than to say, what do I want to do? Sometimes we're not clear in our own mind what we want to do, what we're looking for. And so we tend to reach out and hear somebody else's version of do this, and we do that, and you do learn from that, following instructions given by somebody else to inquire along a spiritual path or lose weight or discover things about your relationship or how to travel in a foreign country. You can always learn something from that. Yet at some point, it's really important to come to a sense of what you want. Now, there's a lot of crackling on the line right now, and I know that sometimes there's background noise. If you have background noise going on, I wonder if you might silence your phone by pressing *6 so we don't have interference on the line. We'll go forward from here. So in Pathwork, I want to give a little bit of an overview. I'm going to use the phrase child consciousness to describe a simple version of living life. So that in child consciousness, if you want something to eat, you go in the cupboard and you get something to eat. In child consciousness, if you want companionship, you go down the road and you knock on someone's door to have a chat with them. In adult consciousness, or in a more adult world, very often things aren't that easy. If you want something to eat, you may have to go out and earn a living to make certain that the cupboard is stocked. So from a child consciousness point of view, very often things are done for you and you're simply participating in them. And from an adult consciousness point of view, you may be the one preparing the larder, preparing the cupboard, creating the environment where you can then access pleasures. In spiritual work, we also have a sense of child consciousness. In spiritual work, we sometimes just want the good things. Sometimes we just want to be loved, and we just want to feel good about ourselves. And I'm using the phrase child consciousness because I'm trying not to put a value on that. There is nothing wrong with that. And in areas of your life where that works, where you simply reach out for something, and for whatever reason, it's available to you or offered to you or you're able to achieve it, that is usually not a place where you need to do a lot of work with yourself. In other areas, you may feel that you have a positive intention and you may try to do something and feel that you're thwarted or blocked or that what you run into over and over again is a sense of negative energy, a sense of not being able to get what you need or to feel good about your life, or to accomplish what you really feel you want to accomplish. What Pathwork teaches is that the spiritual work that human beings have come here to engage in has to do with the parts of them that are in resistance. So we have a divine spirit, we have come from the divine, we have positive intention. But we also bring in a part of us that is not fully willing. Now, I don't like to delineate that, and I'm not sure I want to give it a name, because it is part of us. And you can name part of you without separating from it. So when I name child consciousness, I'm not saying that we are children, and I'm not saying that there's a piece of child consciousness that's stuck to the side of us. I'm simply saying that there is a phase of our consciousness that behaves simply and directly, that responds instinctively to situations, and it carries a certain level of innocence, that doesn't have agendas, that doesn't necessarily think deviously. Not that children aren't devious sometimes, but there's still an innocent quality to a child consciousness trying to get an extra cookie or biscuit, or the child consciousness of not quite wanting to do something. What I'm addressing here is a deeper, more serious part of us, where we come in with positive intention to live life and to connect with others, but we also come in with a spiritual task. And that spiritual task involves allowing ourselves to evolve and grow, but it also involves addressing parts of us that are not highly developed, and again, may be in resistance. A lot of spiritual disciplines focus upon building the positive in us, in making us feel good about ourselves, in creating rituals and situations where we can sense our divine nature, augment it, feel it more strongly, and in effect increase our faith in the positive part of us. Pathwork has been accused or criticized sometimes for spending too much time on the negative. And whether there is truth in that or not, it is what Pathwork does. We focus a lot of time and effort on the distortion. And yet underneath that is a positive intent. By focusing time and effort on the parts of us that are in resistance or in distortion, our belief is that we will free that distortion, that we will release the resistance or move past it, and that there is a larger positive energy that can then move forward faster and freer. So the overall purpose of the Pathwork lectures and techniques and tools is to both access and release the innate positive qualities of our being. And yet, what we address are the blocks to that positive energy and being. So the work, the lectures focus upon where human nature tends to resist, put out blocks, dodge, go around distortions that need to be resolved. So there are a lot of tools and techniques in Pathwork, and I have discussed them at some length over the last year in different teleconferences. Each lecture has suggestions about how you might address a certain issue. But overall, there are tools that it can address almost any issue, and those are what I'm going to focus on. Now, if you've listened to the tapes, you've heard this before, and it may seem redundant. But the truth is, sometimes you need to hear things several times before it makes sense. Sometimes you need to hear things several times because you're not ready for it the first time you hear it. But the third or fourth time, for whatever reason, it sounds more doable. It sounds more reasonable. It sounds like something that might work for you. So repetition isn't always a bad thing. I just notice sometimes that I keep banging the same drum sometimes. So the primary tool to use to become aware of what might be interfering with your life is daily review. And daily review, as I tease people, is simple and free. You can do it anytime. You can start and stop. You can pick it up and put it down. All it is a tool for becoming aware. And this is how it works in its simplicity. Daily review is about spending a few moments every day looking at the glitches that have occurred in your life that day. By glitch, I mean moments of disharmony. So just sitting down either in the morning and reviewing the day before, or in the evening as you go to sleep, or whenever it suits you. And even for some people, they'll do it throughout the day. They'll do it as it happens. It depends on your schedule. It depends on your life. The most important thing is for you to do what feels comfortable to you. You can do a written daily review, or you can do a mental daily review. It depends on whether you can remember these things weeks later. The idea is to sit down, to pause, to reflect once a day upon the things that happened during the day that stung, that hurt, that didn't feel right. There are emotions that we classify as negative. They can be both negative and useful, but we find them uncomfortable. Anger, sadness, grief, frustration, irritation. All these emotions may feel negative or may feel like something that we don't want to have in our lives, but they're also useful. They tell us where something's not working well. So they provide information by saying, over here, look at this. So you're looking for five times, more or less, give or take. Sometimes it's only one, sometimes it's 20. But I'm going to use the figure of five as an example. Let's say five times a day when you were unhappy, where there was disharmony. And the idea is to name the incident in just a few words. For instance, reached for the coffee, spilled it. Now, why would that be disharmonious? Because that might trigger a wave of feeling about, oh, my God, and it's a mess. And it can trigger, just spilling a cup of coffee can trigger criticisms about yourself, concerns about how you'll be seen by others, judgments about your clumsiness. It's just a whole wave of emotions that can be released by the simple act of spilling a cup of coffee. Another example might be when you call someone and you hear in their tone of voice that they may not be happy to talk to you. Such a tiny thing. And yet, depending on your personality and your situation, you may suddenly feel, oh, my God, my friend doesn't love me anymore. Oh, she must be still upset about the incident last week. Nobody loves me. This is the proof of it. Once again, this is very, very unique to you. But when I talk about a disharmony or a negative feeling or a glitch, these vary tremendously from person to person. But I have never met anyone spoken to anyone at any length of time who couldn't name 3 to 5 times in any given day when they felt uncomfortable, ill at ease, or uncertain. And even those can be uncomfortable feelings. So in the daily review, if you're writing it down, it's tremendously important to be brief. So, for instance, in the 2 examples that I named, you might say, called Joan, or spilled coffee. And the next thing you want to notice is what feelings came up. And if they're wildly dramatic and silly, you might as well admit it because that's what they were. Felt abandoned, alone, disliked, or in the case of the coffee, felt stupid, clumsy, and guilty. The third thing you want to look at about those incidents is how you judge them. And the distinction here is the incident itself may contain some information, but the feelings contain your first emotional reaction. After we have an emotional reaction, what very often comes in next is judgment. Our mind takes over and says, this is the reason you feel angry. So, called Joan, felt unloved, and the mind steps in and says, you remember last week when you didn't return her container that she gave you the casserole, I'll bet you she still is, and the whole story begins of reasons why Joan might not have been overly thrilled to receive your call that day. Now, this is important even if later you are given information that you called at a bad time, the dog was barking, the child needed attention, that there were other things distracting her and it had nothing to do with you. That's information. But the truth is that there's also a grain of truth in the fact that you call someone and you hear something in their voice that triggers an emotion and then a judgment. This is what creates disharmony in our lives. This is what brings negativity up for us. And the purpose of daily review is to capture little tiny snapshots of these. Now, in a given day, you might have an Easter egg variety of disharmonies. You might have 5, you might have even 10 disharmonies that just look like a bouquet, and there's no logic, and there's no pattern, and they just seem like 10 random elements. That's one day. The principal use of daily review is to do this for several weeks at a time. And to some extent, you need to do this on faith. You may not see the point of doing this for the first 3 to 5 days or even for the first week. But the miracle that happens in my experience and in the experience of people who use this method is that in a 2-week period, but especially in a 1-month period, if you've got the drive to go ahead and do this for a month and carry around a notebook and make very careful notes about daily disharmony, over a period of 2 weeks to a month, what you will notice is patterns. For instance, you may notice that whenever you go to someone and open a conversation, that if there is any hesitation on their part, you go into negative thought patterns. Now, as a pattern, this indicates that you are ready and willing to presume a negative reason whenever anybody isn't immediately positive and present for you when you start a conversation. Isn't that interesting? And what this pattern can show you is that there is an unconscious expectation of rejection. especially if it happens in a variety of situations and with a variety of people. Now, that may sound like a very, very small and unimportant pattern. But again, what you're looking for is how disharmony, how negativity can exist in your life in a way that is hard for you to pick out and see. And when these things happen in momentary incidents that don't seem to add up to a pattern to your conscious memory, but when you've written them down, you notice that over 2 weeks, at least once a day, but especially every other day, you had a similar reaction to a similar situation that you may not fully understand. Now, I'm not talking about a situation where you fully understand that you called, it was the wrong time, the person was busy, and you need to get out of their way. That's not a disharmony. I'm talking about a disharmony where you get on the phone, and before you realize what these circumstances might be, you have a rush of feeling, especially uncomfortable feelings about what may be going on. So in keeping a daily review for 2 weeks to a month, it is possible to see patterns of disharmony that are more related than you might have realized. Now let's back up for a second. When you are looking for how to improve your life, it's like cleaning a room. You look at a room that's a mess and you move the big things out of the way. You get the dog out, you close the doors or windows, and you clean up you move the large things out of the way. And then there's another layer where you declutter the room. And then there might be a layer where you dust and vacuum. Daily review is especially useful for the equivalent of after you've decluttered a room and basically cleaned it. For looking at this room, which in analogy I'm analogizing to your life, and starting to notice much more subtle layers of clutter and dirt, things that you would like to deal with but have been hard for you to notice. In effect, they're so subtle and so scattered that you couldn't quite get your hands on them, you couldn't quite see what it was you wanted to do. So daily review can give you a sense of a pattern of disharmony that you may previously have overlooked. It is information. Now, what does the information do for you? Again, I'm going to be referencing different lectures throughout this that I had reviewed before. Daily review is covered by two lectures, Password Guide Lecture 28, and also the Path to the Real Self, Lecture Number 5, which reviews, which goes over daily review to some extent. So those two reference documents detail out useful techniques and how to do daily review. Now I'm going to move to what's the point. Now when I talk about awareness, the key lecture that I refer to here is Lecture 127, which is the four stages of evolution. And the essence of that lecture is this, that there are, in the stages of evolution of human consciousness, the first stage is automatic reflex. By that it means that you don't notice what's going on. You are not consciously aware of issues. When you are not consciously aware of an issue, you really cannot deal with it. But the reason it is named is there can be a lot of activity that's going on in your life. You are simply not aware of what it's about. You're not aware that it's a problem. And it passes by without a lot of thought. So to some extent, you really can't work on that area. But the next stage in consciousness, after automatic reflex is awareness. And that is the primary area that we work with. Now, awareness is a huge stage because it can start from a place where you just have a feeling that something's wrong, or even a feeling that something needs to be looked at or addressed. Awareness starts with that very, very, very tiny, bothersome feeling that something's being left undone. And it goes all the way through to the stage where you are horribly aware that you are not doing something, that you see it in front of you in crystal clear vision, in excruciating detail. But the trick with awareness is awareness does not necessarily include the ability to do anything about it. So all the way from that little niggling feeling in the back of your mind that something's wrong to, oh my God, look at this mess. Look at this situation. What awareness does not include is a sense of what to do about it. So awareness can be excruciating. It can be a very difficult phase to go through. And yet, if you haven't got an awareness of what you want to do, what you want to work on, or what needs attention, you can't do anything. So awareness is an extraordinarily important stage, and it can feel like a stage where you are completely impotent. In awareness, you can feel like this is all there is, that you are trapped forever with a personal flaw and no tools to do anything about it. The third stage after automatic reflex and awareness is understanding. In the understanding, it's not simple mental activity. In the understanding, we put the awareness in context. Understanding includes loving, awareness, and perhaps awareness has several definitions, so I'm going to let that go. But in simple awareness, we see things. In loving awareness, we put that knowing in context. Yes, I know we're not a perfect person, and I know that we're trying. It is a blurred line, perhaps, as we move from awareness into an understanding of what this awareness means. So in understanding, we can take the simple information of awareness and help ourselves by supporting let me go back to the original example. So when you make a phone call and you call Joan and you hear this gulp and you interpret, oh, she doesn't want to talk to me, and you go from that to, oh, I remember last week and there was an incident, she probably hasn't forgiven me. That is all awareness. That's not really understanding. That's leaping around saying, oh my God, there's a problem, I think there's a problem, and I don't know how big the problem is. And our mind leaps around, sometimes imagining that the problem is way out of control and much, much bigger than circumstances warrant. In understanding, we try to delineate what's going on, what is the problem, what are the possibilities. In understanding, we may go out and get information. The following day, we may call our friend and say, you know, yesterday when I called you, I felt that my call wasn't welcome. Is there anything we need to talk about? And a friend may tell you that she was busy, or she may tell you that, yes, there is an issue that did not make your call welcome. Understanding is an active process. It's not simply a matter of sitting by yourself and contemplating. understanding is getting information, finding out what the truth is, finding out what the circumstances are, so that you can contain the awareness that you have, but give it context and understanding. The fourth stage of conscious evolution is in knowing. And what knowing represents is a sense of there is an issue, it is uncomfortable, I do understand the circumstances that support it or imprison it or resist solutions, and I have a knowingness that this is okay and it will work out. And what I need to do is relax and let this move on by itself. Now that's a little bit more complicated, so let me put knowing in a common everyday context to give you a better sense of knowing. When we first learned to drive a car, I remember that when I did, I found it impossible to hold the car on the road. I don't know what it was, but in my jerking the steering wheel around, keeping the car on the road was a major event. I couldn't do it. Frightened my aunt, who was giving me driving lessons, it really unnerved her. But I couldn't quite get the knack of keeping the car anywhere on the road. We kept going off the road and weaving from lane to lane on this country road. So I moved at that moment from conscious reflex, which is I could walk and talk and chew gum, and you'd think that I could steer a car, to awareness that I didn't have the muscular control or the understanding of the mechanism to keep the car on the road. Then, as I was coached, I began to understand how I was overcorrecting and going back and forth. And then at some point, you enter this knowing. And in the knowing, without realizing it, you automatically compensate for all this. So as we progress in our driving experiences, mine may have been extreme, but most people have go through something like this when they first learn to drive. At a later stage, some of us drive very, very consciously. Some of us drive with concern about bumping into other cars or remembering the rules. And we've never really relaxed into it. We have to think about it all the time. But the large majority of people have slipped into a knowing about driving a car. And what happens classically is that you get in the car and the next thing you know, you're at the store. And you consciously cannot remember the details of how you got there. And the reason for that is there were no disharmonies. You knew how to drive the car. There were no incidents to remember. You were able to pilot the car or drive the car from a place in you that simply remembered mechanical responses, that your observations of things on the road were so automatic that it seemed like you weren't even looking, but you were. So we would sometimes drive to the store and not even realize what we've done, and yet in returning, if a dog runs into the street or there's a child or there's a car that doesn't quite stop at the intersection, it comes into our awareness. So that we're driving with a deep sense of knowing that has come from a cumulative effect of awareness and understanding. So we relax into the knowing unless new awareness comes up and brings us into a more full consciousness. Now that may sound rather complex, but if you think of driving as an analogy for living a conscious spiritual life, I find that it works fairly well. In the areas where your spiritual life is working in the positive, where you do not have resistance, where you do not have problems, things don't come up. And if they do, you deal with them. So in the knowing of yourself as a good person, you may automatically be polite and courteous. But if a rude, if you are rude for any reason, that pops into your awareness. And you may have to work through an understanding. Oh, I'm tired, or I was irritated, or I was in a hurry. So that you take the awareness of your rude moment, you put the context of understanding around it, and then you drop back into the knowing, where most of the time you are a polite and courteous person. So this dropping into through these four stages happens over and over again throughout our lives in various situations. And a good portion of our life exists in the knowing. We are, in effect, on autopilot for a good portion of our day and our spiritual life, and that is a positive. In the areas where we are not functioning well, that's where awareness comes to us. And being aware of a disharmony is a way of pulling us either from automatic reflex where we are acting without thinking, or bringing us out of a knowing and saying something's gone off. Something's gone off the rails. Something has happened that needs to be dealt with. And we can cycle up into the awareness through understanding of, gee, what is this and what does it mean? Is it recurring or is it just a single incident that I need to take care of? And then we relax into that level of knowing. So being aware of the four stages and realizing where you are in various aspects of your life is a tool that we can use. But the primary value of the tool as I use it is to create a context for those horrible moments of awareness where you realize that something isn't working well in your life, something that you care about very deeply. So what I'm going to repeat is this. In awareness, we may see something is wrong, and we are not yet able to find a context for it. We are not yet ready to understand what's going on. It's a very scary moment, and that moment can last for a long time. But if we, pardon the pun, become aware that we are simply in awareness, that alone will give us a sense that we're going to work this out. We're going to find the larger context. We're going to figure out what's going on and resolve it. So that's covering data review and the four stages of evolution. A third tool that is very valuable for looking at our lives and the disharmonies in our lives is the concept of unity and duality. And that is expressed in Lecture 143. It's a primary concept in Pathwork. And the essence of the lecture is about the human tendency to put things into life and death context without realizing it. So in the lecture, Unity and Duality, it posits the following, that there is a unitive state. There's a state where we are all one. We are all divine beings. We all have a positive intent. And everything is bliss. But that's not what it's like on this planet. That's not what it's like as a human being. So as a human being, what we see is there are things we don't like. There are things that upset us. There are things that that frighten us. And when we see that, we behave in a very primal way. We decide that something is good and something is bad, that something is desired and something is not desired. Now, on a primal level, there's truth to that. As cavemen, it was important that cold will kill you in the winter, in the blizzard, and having a warm campfire will keep you alive. There was a positive, too. When you need food and you have meat available, this is good. And when you need food and food is not available, this is bad. But in 2009, what human beings have done have extended good, bad into all aspects of their lives and their civilizations. We have a tendency to think of things in terms of life-death that are not life-death. They should be regarded as a spectrum. And the reason we do this is because we want something a certain way. So when we want suddenly I'm dropping out. I'm suddenly not finding an example. I don't think I've set this up well enough yet, is why I don't want to go to examples. So in duality, one of the key ways to find whether you're thinking dualistically, you may not see both sides. You may not see the life-death version. But you may be able to see a place where you think something should be avoided at all costs. And what the lecture suggests is that if you allow that for the moment to represent death, it will allow you to notice where you tend to go to the other extreme. So in other words, if you label something as wrong, bad, problem, it automatically makes its opposite attractive. On the other hand, if you label something as I must have it, and I'm differentiating that from it's nice. It's nice is part of a gradation, and it usually doesn't create problems in our lives. But what does create problems in our lives is saying I must have this. This is the only way to be. Anything but this makes me uncomfortable. Now, that sounds very much like, I'd like this, but the important thing is that it excludes other possibilities. I'd like this is a statement that stays open to, I'd like this, that is possible, and, you know, we'll negotiate. The difference would be when we say, I must have this to be happy. And in that statement, what we have done is we have pegged that thing, that thought, that place, that object, that state of being as life. And any other option becomes death. So what I'm describing is in areas where we are not clean, in areas where there are issues in our lives that need to be resolved, we have a tendency to push for one solution or against one solution. So we either identify death and everything else is better or okay, or we identify life and anything else is worse or death. And what that creates is an urgency. It creates a forcing current that does not allow for understanding. It does not allow for seeing other options. So in studying the lecture, Unity and Duality, it can be a way to see where we may have artificially in our lives created urgencies that aren't true. Now this can be, I can go into some examples at this point, this can be as simple as saying, I must have a new dress. It's innocent, I must have a new dress. But I must have a new dress. Put pressure to obtain an object by intimating that not having the object would be disastrous. The must in itself makes the object far more important than it actually is. From a softer place, I'd like a new dress. I feel like a new piece of clothing. I feel like a change in my life. It would make me feel better, and I can afford it, and I think I'd like to explore just putting a different piece of cloth on my body. I think it would be fun. That's quite different from saying, I cannot use my existing wardrobe. I must have a new piece of cloth. When we say that, we're not necessarily willing to engage in discussion about it. We're not necessarily willing to be rational about it. We're not particularly ready to be to listen to you can't afford it. And very often when we say something like, I must, we not only say, I must have a new piece of clothing, dress, suit, or otherwise, we've already picked it out. And it's usually not easy to have. We don't normally say, I must have a new T-shirt, or I must have a new pair of socks. Or they take a lot of effort. And the reason for that is what we've done is we're trying to solve something with an object. We try to solve emotional or spiritual difficulties by being or doing something rather than understanding the situation. So as a tool to understand the concept of dualistic thinking, either or, life, death, can be very, very important because it tells you where something is not clean, where there is a forcing current, where you have artificially decided that a solution would resolve a problem, and you're not willing to look at other options. Now, there's other terminology that goes with the unity and duality lecture. One of the shortcut words that is used is instead of unity and duality, and versus or. So one of the ways where you can see whether you are using dualistic thinking in your life is to say, I want this, but how many other options am I willing to consider? Where is the and here? And if you are unwilling to see other options as viable, it is possible that you have, without realizing it, truncated your thinking into life and death. I must have that, or any other solution is negative. Any other situation is negative. When you are in a place where you say, I would like this object, and there are other choices, I don't care for them, I can see where they are, then you are not in dualistic thinking. When you are in duality, when you are thinking dualistically, you simply don't see other options. It truncates your vision. This is, in effect, tunnel vision. It's like looking down one of those little paper roll holders where you only see a little tiny 1 or 2 inch piece a field in your vision, and you do not see the surrounding area. So the reason to consider whether you are being dualistic, the reason to consider whether you have boiled things down to life death, is because in thinking that one thing is life or one thing is death, you have chosen not to be aware of other options. Now, perhaps you can see in these three tools, and by tools I mean ways of thinking and ways of looking at your problems, that the key here is awareness. The premise is that if you become aware of a problem, and in the awareness, if you are not frightened of it, if you do not think, oh my God, this is the end of the world, the sky is falling, that you'll deal with it. And all of that is because we rely upon our positive intent. The presumption is that we're good people. And if we really see and understand the problem, we'll deal with it. We'll work it out. But if you cannot see that there is a problem, if you cannot be aware of something as an issue, then you certainly aren't going to be able to work with it. So awareness is key. And again, I'm going to say that awareness can be a very, very painful process. Awareness is like opening your eyes and seeing that there's a mess, not completely understanding how it happened, and having some uncertainty about how it can be cleaned up. It's a scary moment to see that you are not the person you want to be, to see that you are behaving in a way that you do not wish to behave in, of seeing that you have created a life situation that you're not happy with and you want to change. But with the context of understanding and seeing how you might have gotten there and what your options are for change, then awareness moving into understanding. It's just not as scary. So in using these three tools, we can afford to become more aware if we feel that there are tools to help us work with the awareness. Now I'm going to take a break for a moment and allow some silence. And when I come back, if you have any questions, I'm happy to work with that. But let me have a moment of silence on this tape so I'll know where to cut it in half.